Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is industry consultant and former manager Mike Gormley. But first of all, let's talk about Spotify Video. Yes, Spotify will now stream video, but it's not for the reason that you think. It's not going to be user-generated videos, music videos, anything like that. Just listen to the partners that Spotify has for their videos. ESPN, Condé Nast, Comedy Central, BBC, NBC, HarperCollins, and Vice Media. What does that sound like? Well, if you guessed advertising, you're right. The reason why Spotify wants to stream video is so that it can add commercials to your music streams. Again, if you're listening on an audio-only player, the video stream won't matter so much, but if you're listening to it with a PC and the online app, then of course you're going to be streamed a commercial. Now, why do they want to do that? Well, the fact of the matter is that out of all the forms of online advertising, the most lucrative is video advertising. And that's why there's so much of it on YouTube. And that's why YouTube makes so much money. And that's why musicians, artists, bands on YouTube make some money as well. It's because video advertising really works. Now, Spotify is trying to make money for the first time because it has a big, big debt. And it's getting deeper in debt as it just got a $500 million capital raise. And is going for another $500 million as well. So Spotify has to make some money, and the best way they think they can do that is by streaming video. So if you're a Spotify user, expect to see some commercials pretty soon. On a related topic, there's a new streaming service out there that's kind of interesting. It's called Cur Music, C-U-R, Cur Music. What's interesting about this is it's a pay-only service, but it's cheaper than everyone else. So for instance, it's usually either zero per month, free tier, or it's $9.99 per month on the premium tier. With Cur Music, they have two tiers. The lowest one is $2.99, and they call that the Octo tier. And the highest one, the premium one, is $6.99, called the Inked tier. Now, both of these are ad-free, and they're more like Pandora than like Spotify. So for instance, it's non-interactive, so you can't call up the song that you want. But a lot of people don't want that. They just want their taste to be known and then have a playlist kind of made for them. So this is what Cur Music might be good for. Now, one of the limitations is the fact that they only have 10 million tracks. 10 million is a lot of tracks, and it's not something that you're going to listen to in your lifetime. That being said, it's not the same as Spotify or Pandora or just about anyone else where they have up to 30 million, 35 million even. Again, more songs than you listen to in your lifetime, plenty of music. But if you're looking for something special, it may not be there. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions at bobbyownercircle.com. Don't forget about my new coaching program. It's 101 mixing tricks, big studio tricks with a small studio. And now you can get it by the module. There's five modules, and you can get each one individually if you so wish. Go to 101mixingtricks.com to learn more. Guitar Center is back in the news, and it's never good news for this company. Of course, last year, four stores tried to unionize. And the big problem there was, even though they voted the union in, Guitar Center really hasn't recognized it. And because of that, because they haven't negotiated with the union for contracts with their employees, there's been a host of lawsuits against GC because of that. Well, because of the lawsuits happening, last week GC suddenly went to their employees in these four stores and they handed them a form to sign. And the form basically said, when you sign, you cannot sue us anymore. Now we're subject to arbitration. Arbitration almost always goes to the side of the employer, not the employee. What's more, GC basically said to the employees, sign this or you're fired. So obviously that's not a very good way to treat your employees. And there aren't many of the good employees left because GC has been trimming the tree, so to speak. They've been getting rid of people for quite a long time, and guess what? They may be getting rid of a lot more real soon. One of the big problems the Guitar Center has is they're swimming in junk bonds. There's more than $1 billion, that's with a B, $1 billion, in a balloon payment coming up soon. The problem is they don't have the money to pay for it. And an even further problem by this is the fact that there's virtually no hope of refinancing or even of Chapter 11 restructuring. Back a few years ago, GC underwent round after round of financial engineering, mostly to make money for the hedge funds that bought in, but also to keep going. And guess what? Junk bonds aren't worth anything anymore. There's no more hope of refinancing or restructuring or doing any of that because now the market has seen through the financial engineering. So the time may be up for GC pretty soon. Basically, Guitar Center used financial engineering instead of a strong business model in order to stay afloat. Now, the way this kind of works is they owed so much money to the bank that they were too big to fail, so to speak. In the financial world, there's a saying that goes something like this. If you owe $1 million to the bank, it's your problem. If you owe $100 million to the bank, it's their problem. And the fact of the matter is, GC owed hundreds of millions of dollars, and that's why they've been kept afloat. If it was anyone else, if it was a smaller entity, they would have been gone a long time ago. So if you're used to buying instruments and accessories from GC, it just might be time to look for another vendor. My guest today is Mike Gormley, who started in the business as head of PR for Mercury Records and later A&M Records, and he had clients like Rod Stewart, Rush, and The Police. Mike later expanded into managing acts like the Bangles, Oingo Boingo, Walla Voodoo, and Danny Elfman. And now he heads up LA Personal Development. I spoke with him via Skype from his home in Los Angeles. So let's go back kind of to the beginning. A lot of people have a hard time breaking into the business. How did you get your first record label job?
I'm not sure. I'll tell you why. I was a columnist and feature writer at the Detroit Free Press, which at the time was fifth largest morning newspaper in North America. And Rob Overman was head of publicity for Mercury Records. And he flew into Detroit one day and we had lunch. I thought he was just being a PR guy and piping me on Rod Stewart or Buddy Miles or somebody at that point. And he said he was leaving Mercury Records and going to manage a band on Columbia Records called Wilderness Road, and wanted to know if I wanted the job. And I had done a little bit of PR before in my hometown in Canada, but anyway, I got the job, and it was in Chicago, and it was more money, and it was a few months before Rod's album Every Picture Tells a Story comes out. So I go from a cubicle at the Detroit Free Press to an office in Chicago overlooking the city of Chicago. And two secretaries.
Wow.
And I literally sat there tapping my fingers on the desk going, what do I do now? And I looked out the window and there was the Playboy building. And that magazine goes to 7 million people. I should probably get together with them. And I did. And they ended up doing a story on Rod Stewart. And I found out after the fact that it was the first pop star that they had ever done a story on. So ignorance can pay off. they're a big publication. I'm supposed to be doing publicity. Let's go see them. And it ended up being a nice big story on Rod and timed well with Maggie May coming out and all that sort of stuff. So I had a bit of an instinct for it, I guess.
So there was no one to teach you the ropes then? They just threw you in?
I had people working for me who knew more about it than I did. You know, I mean, I had a New York office, the Chicago office, an LA office, and there, especially in New York, there were people who knew more about it than I did. But My father had done PR. I had done some PR in Ottawa on a local level. I just had a knack for it. And I don't know if Ron saw that or he just wanted to fill the space. I'm not too sure why he came to me, except they, a lot in those days, they thought journalists knew about PR, which of course is a different science entirely, but I had a lot of contacts, I guess. And there I was, head of publicity for Mercury Records, and Rod Stewart's Every Picture Tells a Story to come out. And I knew Rod a little bit. I had interviewed him and seen him in Detroit as a journalist. So it worked out quite well.
Yeah, but one advantage that you have as a former journalist in that situation is the fact that you know how you want to be treated and you know how you want to be pitched. And I think that gives you an advantage, because otherwise, you know, it can be, you know what it's like when you have somebody that's just being a hard ass pitching you and doesn't quite understand what you're going through. So I think that's a distinct advantage.
Yeah, you're right. There probably is that element. And I think because of that, a lot of those journalists are still friends of mine or you know, we're connected in some way. I was backstage at a heart show in Phoenix, Arizona, several years ago. And I introduced myself to them. And over to my right, I hear my name repeated, and I turn around, it's Cameron Crowe, who was, of course, at that time married to one of the members of Heart. And he came over and gave me a big hug, which put me in with Heart quite nicely.
Yeah.
And, I guess I didn't realize that there's a lot of camaraderie from those days. And I used to call him at Rolling Stone and talk to him about Rod.
Oh, yeah, sure. And, I'm curious, what exactly would be your day like back then? And what I'd like to do is draw the contrast between PR that you did then and maybe what would happen today.
Yeah. Big changes, but the approach is basically the same. I'll tell you my first day, which was not a typical day. There I am in this office. I'm telling you, this office was like somebody's living room. It was huge. And two secretaries out there. And, in those days, long distance calls could be kind of rough in terms of connection, especially overseas calls. So I get an overseas call. And I can't hear the person on the other end of the line at all, and no one told me who it was. So I'm hearing this crackling sound and I'm going, I can't hear you. I'm sorry. I hear this crackling sound about three times. And finally I say, I can't hear you. And very clearly, and very plainly, it's Rod fucking Stewart. So that was my first day. But the typical day, I had a department to take care of. I was learning the job on the job, and I had actual PR to do. And so, yeah, I would be calling Cameron Crowe or whoever it might be and trying to get stories for artists. But I'd also be, you know, making sure people who were working for me were doing what they were supposed to be doing. And we had at Mercury Records in those days, you were expected to be in at 9 o'clock and work into the night. I wasn't used to that. I was a columnist in a major newspaper. I would arrive at 11, you know, I mean, it took me a while. It actually physically changed me for a while to have to get up early and actually be somewhere at 9 o'clock. But and then you'd go out to concerts at night, and then they still expect you to be in there at 9 o'clock. And took a while to get used to that. But I understood after a while that was a way to stay organized and stay focused. If you remained, you know, coming in late and all that sort of stuff, it was a kind of a lesson. But you were there early, and you often had meetings late in the day, and I learned from a lot of people around me. And, what I did during the day was get on the phone and get interviews with people. I would see bands going into certain cities, and I would I'd have a Rolodex and call the local publication and maybe a morning TV show I wouldn't normally call radio stations, but sometimes for interviews, I would. Promotion guy usually took care of that, but sometimes when it was nothing to do with airplay, but actual interview, I might call a radio station at that point. And then I try to be innovative. I actually got airplay on some R&B stations, as they were called then, on Maggie May, inadvertently, because I quoted the lyrics, and in the lyrics was a reference to playing pool. And for some reason, they liked that, and they started playing the record. You know, so I always tried to find different ways to do things and be creative with what was going on and to get to creative outlets. So there was, I would just try to find maybe TV shows that wouldn't normally have, or the Playboy thing. Mm-hmm. I just went over there and they did a story on Rod, and I just didn't care, nor did I really know at that point that they didn't do pop artists. Shows you how much I read Playboy then. You know, yeah. They did mainly jazz. So I just found other ways of doing things. But today, there's so many outlets. There's bloggers, and there's, man, it just goes on. There's online publications. There's podcasts like yours. You know, there's so much going on that you get people being publicists, being specialists in certain areas. I got a call today from a friend who has started a company that's catering to online radio stations strictly. That's not news, but it just shows now it's becoming narrow casting or narrow PR, if you will. You got to really know if there's somebody out there who knows all of these people and all of these places. I got to meet him or her because it's tough to keep track of it all. But the basic approach is the same. If an artist is going into town, I mean, I did. I like to work with Ron Stone periodically. I don't do PR that much, but I help out Ron Stone and stuff. And he had Ray Davies on tour a couple of years ago. It was the same calling, whether it's a TV station or a radio station. Of course, what he was going to do was limited. And it was interesting because we put together a Ray Davies day in San Francisco. I can't remember if it was a radio station involved or what it was, but we put it all together. And I had to tell the guy that I cannot guarantee you that Ray Davies will show up.
Oh.
So he put the whole thing together. He had a theater crowded with people. Ray showed up, thank God. he went for it. But it's just that basic contact with somebody. Call them up and somebody's coming to town and you want to arrange an interview. It's the same. It's the same. It's just a wider range of people and places to approach.
Now, you were part of A&M during the glory days, really. Yeah. How did that come about? What was it like?
Well, they kind of had several glory days, you know. I mean, they had some great times, you know, with Joe Cocker, the Carpenters, whoever, before I got there.
Yeah.
But I did get there on time for the Police and Squeeze and Supertramp and then Herb's last number one record took place while I was there, which was and his first one in many years at that point. So yeah, there was a lot of magic stuff going on.
The lot was magic. I always thought there was just a vibe when you walked on, and it was probably the ghost of Charlie Chaplin or something. I don't know, but there was just something magic about that whole thing.
It was a lot to do with the people. Well, a lot to do with Herb and Jerry.
Yeah,
they set a mood.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, Herb might want to have a meeting, and he'd call you over to your office, and you'd. At first, I had to remove from my head that this is Herb Alpert I'm sitting talking to, you know, it's just, and he helped you do that. He just called, he didn't say anything or do anything. It was just himself, which is a sweet guy, but it was a business too. And you had to pay attention to that aspect of it. But it was, sounds like a cliche, but it was a family. And to this day, it's still a family. There's an A&M website. There's A&M people stay in touch. There's a Facebook site where you can go on. I can go find out what so-and-so is doing now. If somebody is somebody has a hit, you A&M people are cheering for him or her. If there's an illness or somebody passes away, the word goes out. You know, when Gil Friesen passed away a couple of years ago, it was instant information and information regarding where there would be a celebration of his life and so on and so forth. And I, when I went there, it was all those people getting together, some of whom hadn't seen each other in years and some had stayed in touch. But that family aspect continues to this day. And that was how you did business at A&M. You just somehow worked together.
How did you get into management? And I ask that because it seems like a logical step that happens, especially with PR guys. I mean, you just mentioned the guy that got you hired into Mercury went into management, and it just seems like that happens. Why and how?
In my case, you know, Miles Copeland, who managed the Police and Squeeze and started IRS Records and was a powerhouse in the industry and particularly at A&M, I was one of the few people he didn't scream at for some reason. It didn't, you know, for some reason we got along and became friends. And I would hang out at IRS a fair amount because you'd come out of my office and make a right turn and there was IRS Records. And, you know, you went over there and you bumped into REM and bumped into a lot of these fantastic people who were coming up at the time. And I just gravitated over to that direction every once in a while. And I was tired of being a record executive. I was tired of being not as creative as I wanted to be and running a fairly large department. I was excited about the music and, as I said, the people I'm working with, but the job itself wasn't that satisfying, and Miles knew that. So he just came to me and he said, look, at that time he was still living in London. Their career was skyrocketing, and it hadn't peaked by any means. It was just skyrocketing, which means he had no time for almost anything other than the Police. But in the middle of that, he signed two bands. He started a company in L.A., a management company, and he signed Oingo Boingo and Wall of Voodoo. And so he came to me and he said, why don't you come over and, you know, you'd be part of management for those bands and anybody else we sign. Run the U.S. office, if you will, for his. It was a separate management company than what he had for the Police. So it sounded good to me, and it turned out to be great. And so I started in about, I think it was 1983 or something, started with Oingo Boingo and Wall of Voodoo. And about 6 months later, we signed the Bangles. And that's what I did for the next few years, those three bands. And that's how I got into management. I did this in my career a lot. I did things that I didn't really know how to do. And I remember sitting at my desk, and Wall of Voodoo was about to go on tour, and we had to put a tour budget together, which I'd never done. And I mean, you know, I was in PR. I didn't do that stuff, but it was logical. I mean, we just sat down and figured it out. And again, I was allowed to be creative and thinking up different ways of getting the bands out there, and had great support because they were signed to FBI booking agency, which was Miles's brother. So we ended up having the Police, and then we had IRS Records and an FBI booking agency and LAPD management. And it was all connected, but separate companies. Our one connection was Miles. So I had that kind of support. But Miles threw me in a deep end of the pool. There's no doubt about it. But fortunately, I had enough fortitude and experience that it didn't scare me. It was just new and interesting. And they were young bands, so they were working with me. At that point, Oingo Boingo would sell out the Whiskey, which isn't bad, but it isn't what they ended up doing.
Yeah.
Wall of Voodoo was relatively new. The Bangles, when we met them, were called the Bangs and changed bass players in the midstream. So that was a rather infancy kind of approach. So, and then over the years in my office, people would be wandering in. I remember Adam Ant would come over and hang out, and guys from Chili Peppers would come over. I remember them telling me that they finally found a name, Red Hot Chili Peppers. And I remember thinking, wow, what a weird name. But, you know, it was an interesting and very creative world. Wall of Voodoo was a very creative band. And people kind of think Stan Ridgway was that. And he was a very definitely creative guy, but it was a band that did that. And so it was great fun developing these bands and getting them going. And the first thing I did, though, was interesting. I went into, you know, Gil Friesen was the president of A&M. And when I left A&M, he was my immediate boss, you know. And the first thing I did was go to A&M and get Oingo Boingo off the label. And I had a meeting with Gil, and I knew he didn't particularly like them, and they weren't selling tons of records. So we left with a $400,000 debt or something like that, and signed him to MCA. That was the first thing I did as a manager. Miles was off with the police and off in London, so I was on my own to a great degree. But again, had good friends around me and got to know his staff in England. Great people. It was good times. And we had a lot of success. We had a lot of success.
Yeah, definitely. How would you contrast management then and management now?
Well, you know, in my case or our case, is people started talking about how important the manager was becoming because the labels weren't developing artists anymore. And so it was up to the management company to take new artists or medium level artists and expand their careers and so on. That didn't strike me as new. That's what we always did. When I'd sign a band to a label, I would say, our work has just begun. Getting signed to the label is not the answer. Ignore the label. You're signed to the label. We'll make use of them when the time comes. Right now, we got to make sure we tour, make sure you make new music, make sure we're doing what we were doing when we were independent. Because when the Bangles signed to Columbia, for example, they'd already toured the country a couple of times. They were appearing in a lot of magazines, which, you know, had a level of more than now, I guess. And they had raised their profile a great deal. So when we signed to Columbia, first off, we didn't even know David Kahn was looking at us and Peter Philbin. We didn't even know they were scouting the band. We were going along our merry old way and touring with English Beat and whoever it might be and carrying on. So when they came along, it was a bonus, but we had our own thing going and we stayed with that. Whatever the label can bring to the party, great, but we're going to act like independents. And that's the way it goes now, is now you have to develop the artists and work out all the possibly touring you know, maybe their own label or act like they're on their own label. We did that. We did that with Walla Voodoo was on IRS, so that was like an in-house thing in a way. Oingo Boingo was its own animal, and we built them up and presented them. I don't mean to remove label people as if they were inconsequential, but they were. But we came into the deal knowing what we wanted to do and where we wanted to go and how we wanted to get there. So it's kind of the same today, but I don't know how many people were doing that back then. I mean, a lot of people would sign the labels and go, okay, take me to the top.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And you couldn't do that. You had to come in with some ideas. So we've been doing it all along. It's just more prevalent now. And ironically, just on a new client of mine, I approached a couple of labels just today, smaller, independent labels, because I still believe a label can get you a certain national, international profile that you might get yourself, but it's going to take a longer time. So there's certainly aspect to the labels that's really good for an artist, but then there's an aspect to a label that can be really tough for an artist. So you just have to think for yourself and look at the label as a partner who's going to help you get to where you want to go. You can't go in there expecting them to tell you what to do, nor should you let them tell you what to do. You got to have your own goal.
Yeah, yeah. It seems like it's a lot more difficult to break an artist these days for many reasons, but one that I can think of that keeps on jumping out at me is the fact that there's so many fewer places to actually go and gig than there used to be.
Yeah. Very tough. It's very tough. I don't book dates per se, but I have friends out there. If I have an artist that wants to go on tour, I'll give him a suggestion as to what he or the agent should call. There are so many artists that makes it more difficult. But I may suggest a place here and there, and I'll find out the place closed last year.
Yeah,
it's just not uncommon to come across that. It's sad on one level, but there's still a lot of places. And I mean, I feel really optimistic in a lot of ways about the way the business is now. It always was difficult. Now it's difficult in a different sort of way. And I'm talking about, you know, I'm not in the hip hop world or the rap world. So what I'm referring to is more rock, more alternative, independent artists, that kind of thing. There may be more places for artists like that. There may be, because you can play smaller clubs for a while and then build up. You don't have, you know, the pattern in the past was start out with playing some clubs and then hopefully get on some bigger gigs. And meanwhile, you're getting on the radio, and if they're getting on the radio in Chicago, you get there as fast as you can and do a show. And you build, there were steps you could take. Now there's steps, but they're all over the place, and they're, and there's fewer of them. And it's not that it was a formula back then, but at least you had guidelines, and the guidelines now are being made difficult by, as you mentioned, fewer places to go and just be in front of people. And being in front of people now is the main thing.
Yeah, I don't think that's ever changed.
Yeah, I'm working with a great little band in Dallas called Moonwaves. They're young, they're 18 years old. Their favorite band is Jefferson Airplane. And you know, they relate back to the 60s and that sort of thing, although they're 18 years old, which I like. But it's just they're a new band that's going to work Dallas and Texas for a while and not worry about a label deal, not worry about making an album. They're going to make some what we would call singles and probably do videos for them and get the word out that way. You build up to it now rather than, I don't know why a lot of people worry about it. Well, full, see, I'm saying the word album here, but, you know, recording or whatever we call it.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's still valid.
Yeah, but it's 11 or 12 songs. You don't have to do that anymore. You can if you want, but you can do two or three songs and get and build up a following and then deliver a full album to that fan base who's already there waiting for you.
That's the way it was in the 50s and the 60s where you only could do a couple of singles. And if they were successful, then you got to do an album. So way different.
I just finished reading, I got for Christmas, Peter Guralnick's book, The Man Who Invented Rock and Roll, the story about Sam Phillips. And it's all about that. You know, he started in the early 50s with blues artists, with Howlin' Wolf and Ike Turner.
Yeah.
And that's what he would do. He made singles and he'd make a deal with Chess and he made a deal with, I've forgotten the distributors, the independent distributors who he eventually came to hate. But in the beginning, that's how he got his music out there. And that's how anybody got their music out there, singles. I don't think when he started, albums were even a factor. I think they became a factor within a couple of years. I don't think it's a bad formula. You know, get people loving you and then deliver them a full picture of what you do. There's so much going on and so many ways of listening and so many artists out there. You can't expect them to even be able to focus on a whole album.
Yeah.
They're going to go to two or three tracks anyway. So give them two or three tracks. And then if it's fine, everybody loves you, give them some more, you know, or maybe in a full form.
Yeah. I think the way that it's changing too is more singles, more material that's more frequent. So every 6 or 8 weeks or 10 weeks or whatever, it's better to come out with something and feed your fan base and maybe expand it a little bit. And then the other advantage is the fact that every time it's a new event. So if you put an album out, that's one event and whatever the single is. And if you do 10 songs that are singles, that's 10 events and plus the album, that's 11. So, you know, it seems like it's a better way to do it, I would think.
Yeah. You might remember in the days of MTV, you would say, well, you have to make a video.
Yeah.
And then that went away. Now you have to make a video again because the biggest radio station or record company, whatever you want to call it, is YouTube.
Yeah.
Fortunately, you can make an interesting video on your iPhone or whatever. You don't need the full crew and the cameras and the expense. You can make them in your living room and people accept that. And sometimes people even like that more than the fancier videos. And so, yeah, you might need a video now, but it's not like you need to spend $100,000 on it. You can spend nothing on it or next to nothing on it. And people don't judge you by that. They just are listening to the music.
I've had some label people, especially from the larger indie labels, tell me that they're just as happy with a lyric video that they could put out. Or sometimes if they need it out day and date, just a picture of the band or the artist and, you know, overlaying the music. And they get just as much action or nearly as much action with that as from a fully produced video. and it's a lot more cost effective. And again, if you can have something out day and date, it's a lot better.
I'm working on a thing now. There's an artist who's been around for a while named Daryl Purpose, like a folk artist, for lack of any other descriptive term. And we're looking at videos. We're looking at one. He has one song. This isn't coming out for several months, but he has one song that's about the death of Edgar Allan Poe. And I happen to have a friend who's made a beautiful film about Edgar Allan Poe. So next week we're going to sit down and we're going to use pieces of the film as the video for the song. And we may or may not put Daryl in there somewhere. It may not matter. But that's what I said earlier about being creative. You find ways of doing it. There's another song we may do on his record that we may do in animation. And there's a studio that will do animated videos for relatively little money. And so we may do a different song that way. And, you know, so it's fun to find ways to get around. I've been in the indie world now so long that I automatically look for ways to do something for nothing.
Yeah.
You know, I haven't had a label head to call for a long time to say, I need more money for the video. We just had to do it ourselves.
Yeah.
So you come across some really creative people when you're scrambling like that. And I find it a lot of fun.
When I talked to you the other day, New Year's Eve, actually, we saw each other at a party. You told me that you were consulting. What does that mean exactly?
The full management approach is almost you're a member of the band in a way, and you're suffering along with the band, and I find consulting to be a little more organized, and I can come up with ideas and I can suggest connections, but I'm not necessarily chasing all over the place trying to find those connections. I can say, okay, here's what you do, you know, and here's who you call. So it's a consulting and supporting. I guess it's kind of a fine line. It just isn't as time consuming. It isn't as emotionally consuming. Although every artist I have, I break a leg for, you know, but there is a subtle difference. And it's just not quite as all encompassing as what management used to be.
No, I get it. Makes perfect sense.
And it goes along with the indie thing. So you're an indie artist and here's what you need to do. But I think I can help you do that, as opposed to, here, I'll take over your career and we'll go off and rule the world.
Yeah.
You know, it's almost impossible to do that now unless you've just got a huge organization behind you with a lot of money. So in the indie world over here, us in the indie world have to find ways to make it work. And so I'm there to help people make it work or find ways to make it work. But I'm not on the bus with them, you know, or the band or the station wagon or whatever it might be.
Yeah. I hear you. Last question. What's the best piece of music business advice that you either learned along the way or someone imparted to you?
One aspect of it is don't give up. And a lot of people say that, you know, it's a little bit of a cliche, don't give up. And it's really, really difficult to not give up sometimes. You know, it can be just heartbreaking what can happen to an artist of any kind, musician or otherwise. The rejection that can happen, I hesitate to use the word failure, because, you know, it's just not a failure when somebody hands you, or these days sends you, a link to a song they've written. The guts it takes to reveal that, you know, just think about it. Just do it sometime. Go ahead and write some lyrics and send them to a musician sometime and say, can you do this? It is. And I've done that more for the fun of it than anything. But when I actually was sending the lyrics to somebody, they could write back and say, you're an idiot. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You're revealing your soul when you just hand over. And whether it's good or bad, you have done that. And rejection is good. It's almost automatic, except on rare occasions. So you got to just keep on going. You got to just not give up. If you truly, truly believe in what you can do, something's going to happen. But the motto of my company is activity breeds activity. If you do nothing, nothing's going to happen. But if you do something, you don't know what, you don't know where, or maybe you do, something's going to happen. I would take artists to functions, you know, to parties or whatever, and we'd leave and they'd say, why did we go there? And I would say, I don't know, but I'll tell you when it happens. You know, that guy we met, that situation, it happens all the time. If you're active, you're going to come across somebody who's got something for you or believes in you or whatever the case might be. So, yeah, that's my motto. It's activity breeds activity. Just keep on going and don't give up. And you may not reach that goal you think is your goal, but it'll have ultimately a positive effect on you in some way.
That's a great motto, a great saying. Very cool.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for your time today. This is great. It was as much fun as I had expected, and I'm really pleased that you did this.
I enjoyed it a great deal. Thanks.
To find out more about Mike, you can go to his LinkedIn page, or you can go to lapdev.com. That's lapdev.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Many thanks to Steve Cherubino. He's the host of the EDM Producer Podcast at edmmr.com. Thank you, Steve. He helps put the show together. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, or Google Play. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I'll see you next time.